on the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
LATalkRadio.com. It is Friday, April 26th. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're joining us live, you're one of the few that happen to know about it, although I did tweet and Facebook this morning about our program. This concludes our first week of broadcasting from the great studios here in Sherman Oaks at LATalkRadio.com and the MariaSanchezShow.com. Next week, we're going to be more public with it, but just wanted to make sure that we got some of the kinks out of the system. And since I'm a Stunod technologically going through my learning curve, I think I'm getting there. We are going to have a fairly controversial but very interesting and wise and learned guest for the duration of the program after I go through the top five news stories as we do every morning. Stephen Savota is joining us. We are going to be speaking about circumcision and his stand about that. He founded an organization called Attorneys for the Rights of the Child, and he's going to be visiting with us in just moments. But the five stories that you should be following or knowing about this morning is that the Boston bombing suspect has been moved to a prison at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. It's 39 miles west of Boston. It specializes in inmates who need long-term medical or mental health care. So that happened today. His parents have left their home for another part of Russia. The father was supposed to have come to the United States to cooperate in the investigation, but his trip has been delayed indefinitely. Now, the mother is unable to come because she is wanted on charges of felony charges of shoplifting and destruction of property. So she won't be coming. And I don't know if you saw her interview yesterday, but she claims that she thinks that her sons were set up, that it was a ploy, that it wasn't blood, that it was red paint. And the woman is, I think, delusional, because, I mean, please. The other thing that's out in the news about that story today is the Boston Globe published an interview with the 26-year-old man of Chinese origin who goes by the name of Danny, who was the carjack victim. It was his Mercedes SUV that they took that ran low on fuel, and when they stopped for gas, he was able to escape. But he said, because he drove around with them, or they drove him around for 90 minutes, and they told him that they had just killed a police officer and that they admitted that they had done the Boston Marathon bombing. So, of course, you've got to figure that this guy's thinking that his time on this planet is not for long. And he said, in his quote is, "I don't want to die. I have a lot of dreams that I haven't come true yet." So he's trained as an engineer, and he said at first that they were kind of puzzled by his Chinese accent. After they determined that he was indeed Chinese, then the elder, Tamerlan, identified himself as a Muslim. And Danny said, "Chinese are very friendly to Muslims. We are so friendly to Muslims." So I guess that outsider status helped keep them calm so that he wasn't going to be one of their next victims. There's another story out today that a belief in God or a higher power may improve treatment for those suffering from depression. Faith in a higher being has been found to significantly improve treatment for people suffering with a psychiatric illness. This is according to research carried out at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. Researchers found that patients with no or only slight belief in God were twice as likely not to respond to treatment than patients with higher levels of belief. And researchers concluded that a belief in God is associated with improved treatment outcomes in psychiatric care. This was published in the Journal of Affective Disorders. And the quote is, "Our work suggests that people with a moderate to a high level of belief in a higher power do significantly better in short-term psychiatric treatment than those without, regardless of their religious affiliation." And so they say belief was associated not only in improved psychological well-being, but a decrease in depression and intention to self-harm. And an aside to this story, which I hadn't known about, was another study about the power of prayer. So we share these things with you so that you get to know a little bit about what's going on in the world, and then you can make your own decisions and see whether or not this coincides with your personal beliefs. But again, this was a scientific study, this one conducted at San Francisco General Hospital, monitoring the effects of prayer on 339 cardiac patients. So here's the story about this study. The patients were asked in the hospital if they wanted to take part in a trial, but they weren't told what the trial was about. And so those that agreed, the 393, were divided into two groups. Half were prayed for by a group of strangers who had the patients' names. That was it. Those who were prayed for, and keep in mind, this is a person in a hospital not knowing that somebody's praying for them, and a person that's praying for them not knowing who they're praying for other than their name. Those who were prayed for had fewer complications, fewer cases of pneumonia, and needed less drug treatment. They also improved more quickly and were able to leave the hospital earlier. Now, if you weren't a believer, I would think maybe you might start believing in something. So another study at Columbia University in New York asked strangers to pray for strangers who were going through fertility treatments in Korea. So they asked people in Australia, the United States, and Canada to pray for names of peoples going through the IVF treatment in Korea. The success rate for implantation of the embryo in the womb went up from 8% to 16% in the group that was being prayed for, and the cases of successful conception, where the fetus started developing, went from 25% to 50%. Again, a group of people being prayed for by strangers, and that's doubling the success rates. Fourth story, George Jones has passed away at 81, the country crooner. He had a career illustrious, 150 albums. He had a number one hit in numerous decades. I believe it was five decades. They called him the Frank Sinatra of country. He battled alcoholism and some drug addictions, and they used to call him No Show Joe, Big George, because of that, or No Show Jones. Married to Tammy Wynette, had a volatile, tempestuous relationship, but created lots of great music and great country songs. And finally, the story that we think that you might want to pay attention to, Roundup. Heavy use of the world's most popular herbicide could be linked to a range of health problems and diseases, including Parkinson's, infertility, and cancers. This was a scientific study in Entropy, and it is because of residues of glyphosate. It's the chief ingredient in Roundup weed killer, which is sprayed over millions of acres of crops, and that's been found in our food. So this study was authored by a research scientist at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And the EPA is going to review this element, glyphosate, and they've set a deadline for 2015. So my advice is that you might want to err on the side of caution, and I wouldn't suggest that you eat the biotech crops that have been created by Monsanto, who is the maker of Roundup, which would be their corn, soybeans, canola, and sugar beets, because the reason these genetically modified crops are liked by farmers is because they can spray Roundup weed killer directly on the crops to kill the weeds without harming the crops. But this study is saying that it's actually going through to and finding its way into us. So without further ado, we're going to contact Stephen Savoda. He is going to be speaking with us about genital integrity and circumcision. This is raw radio, by the way, you can tell.
Hello.
Stephen, it's Maria Sanchez. Good morning.
Hey, Maria, I was getting a little concerned because there was some guy on your station after 9 a.m., so I was wondering what was happening.
Or were you listening to Channel 2?
Oh, is there more than one channel?
Yes. I'm glad.
I was going to try to record it just as a backup. I didn't realize there was more than one channel.
You know what? I'm glad you're bringing this up.
We have a few minutes before we're on, right?
No, actually, you're on the air right now.
Oh, okay.
But you know what? I'm going to send you the link, and then you can send it to your people.
Okay.
So we've got that covered. So, Stephen,
okay.
Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, and the Maria Sanchez Show listeners, I'd like you to introduce you to Stephen Savoda. Stephen, I'm going to say, he's been a correspondent with me. We figured out it was January of 2003 was our first visit. That was when I was with the NPR affiliate. And we've been speaking about genital integrity and genital mutilation and circumcision issues over the years. Stephen has his bachelor's degree from UCLA, his master's degree from Cal Berkeley, and his doctor, what do we call it, Juris Doctor, law degree from Harvard Law School, and was a classmate with President Obama, which I remember you telling me that when he was first running for president, you said that you were classmates with him, and you gave him the compliment that he was a bright man.
Yeah, we knew each other pretty well in law school. I haven't been in touch since then, but he's a very impressive person, always has been.
And do you recall anything different or special about him? Remarkable?
Oh, there was lots special about him. I mean, one was how unassuming he was, despite how intelligent he was. Like, he's the kind of guy that you'd invite over to your house and have him, you get down on his knees and play with your kid. And, you know, very unpretentious. And just the intellect is just amazing. I mean, he's just one of these people who can just see something quicker than anybody else. And I did not expect him to be a politician. I mean, that was not the impression he gave. He just gave the impression of this really sharp, incredibly sharp, motivated, amazing person. Hmm. I did not expect him to go into politics.
Well, and there you have it. So Stephen is on our program this morning as the Attorneys for the Rights of the Child, or ARCLAW.org. And when did you found that, Stephen?
Early 1997.
Okay, and what was the genesis for it?
Well, I first heard about this issue in 1989. I was out in the Bay Area while I was in law school, and I got exposed to it. And frankly, it seemed a little odd to me at first.
Wait.
I tried to be a fair-minded person, and I sort of through various more or less coincidental events over a number of years, I kept sort of being exposed to it, and I finally decided I had to look into it more because it just seemed to keep turning up in my life. And so,
Stephen,
I came in touch with another organization. I had somebody mentor us in the early years of ARC, and it's you know, we've never looked back. I mean, my initial plan was to spend 7 years in the movement maximum and then be out of it, but we're at 16 years and counting now, so that plan failed.
So the issue being genital mutilation or circumcision.
Right. And a number of different terms are used for that. And it's interesting because there are so many different terms and they each sort of reflect a different way of looking at it. And the terminology does have importance because it sometimes sort of summarizes what the viewpoint of the person talking about the issue is. And one real common dividing point is how people view male genital cutting versus female. I mean, some view them as equivalent. Some view the female cutting, which, of course, we deplore, and we also work against that as well as male circumcision. Some view the female practice is much worse. And for us, I mean, we don't see a lot of value in making these comparative judgments. Human rights law doesn't say that if practice B is worse than practice A, but there are both human rights violations, then practice A is acceptable. So it really becomes an academic discussion. But they're both clearly against the law and violating human rights. And those are really important points for us.
Okay, so let's go backwards now and talk about circumcision, why it was created, and what are the numbers today in the world? What are the numbers today in the United States? And what are the numbers today in California, since both you and I are residents of the state?
Well, the practice started several thousand years ago as a religious practice, so-called religious practice. Although, as Frederick Hodges pointed out in the symposium in Helsinki last October, people tend to be much more conclusory about the history than may actually be merited. There's this old Egyptian bas-relief from like 5 or 6 thousand years ago that often turns up in articles about circumcision, and it's supposed to show a circumcision, but Frederick pretty convincingly showed that in fact it probably isn't a circumcision, it's probably something else. There's a lot of myths about the procedure. It certainly has gone on for a while. I don't really consider that all that relevant, frankly. I mean, there's lots of practices that went on for a long time that have since been discontinued because we've realized that they weren't a good idea, they were inhumane, whatever, whether you're talking about slavery or, of course, slavery still goes on in parts of the world, but whatever issue you're talking about. And I'm not equating certainly slavery with anything else. I'm just saying that for me, that the historical background to practice is not really, doesn't really address whether it's a valid practice we want to be doing today.
Okay.
As far as the U.S. goes, or as far as medicalized circumcision in the U.S. goes, the procedure that's not religiously motivated, that started about 150 years ago. There was some physicians, well-meaning physicians. I mean, of course, that period was very ignorant compared to modern-day knowledge, and some physicians thought that it actually would be helpful for a wide range of conditions. And the real puzzling issue is not so much why did it start as a medicalized procedure, but why did it continue? Because if you look at the progression, you'll see that as one suggested reason for the procedure was disproven, a new one was slotted in to fill its place. We had what used to be called venereal disease as a suggested rationale for male circumcision. We had cervical cancer was suggested. We had penile cancer as a suggestion. The latest thing is AIDS and HIV. And all of these arguments have never been shown to hold any water. And the question becomes, well, you're causing harm. Why do we have this compulsion to try to justify something when the default should be that you don't do it? I mean, there's no other procedure like this where people are out there seeking for rationales for cutting off functional body tissue. This is the only one. It's unique in so many ways, and that's one of the ways.
So why do you think that the United States has kept up the practice and the rest of the world has not?
Well, the rest of the world hasn't kept it up as a majority practice, except for South Korea, which sort of followed us. But it still is done in the Anglophone world, but it's just not to the extent it's done here. I do think that to some extent the other countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the UK, they're all sort of following us in a sense. I mean, it started in the U.S. as a medicalized procedure and sort of inertia has carried it over, but there's a few reasons for it, and nobody knows really exactly why, and that's one of the mysteries, but part of the answer is social inertia, I think, and part of the answer is it's a very uncomfortable thing to admit when you've done something that either had something done to yourself that might have harmed you, or had something done to your child, or had something done to someone else who's close to you. I mean, that's a very hard thing to admit. It's much easier to find a reason to justify continuing the practice, and especially when the majority of the males around you have had it done, it just becomes an understandable thing. And the medical profession hasn't really stepped up and given the level of scrutiny to this that would be appropriate. The American Academy of Pediatrics, as you know, is still in 2012 trying to justify this practice, and they're, of course, the leading trade association for pediatricians. So that's really quite shocking.
So tell me, Stephen, let's go get to some numbers here. So what are the world numbers and what are the American numbers of who's circumcised and who isn't?
Nobody knows the exact numbers, but in the U.S., you've had something on the order of a million circumcisions a year, and the numbers have gone down a little bit lately, which is good news. And of course, a lot of the circumcisions that happen outside the U.S., the majority are done by Islamic people who believe that it's required by their religion, which there's good evidence that that's incorrect. I'm not Islamic, but I'm sure that by people who have studied this issue that it's not actually true that it's required religiously. And even if it were required religiously, there's plenty of things that you can find in the Bible that we just don't do anymore because we couldn't realize that they don't make any sense. I mean, somebody pointed out that the religious writings also require circumcision of your servants. Well, who does that anymore? People even have servants. I mean, these rules are just so outmoded that it becomes laughable to try to use them as justifications for what we're doing in 2013.
But also Jewish people circumcise for religious reasons. They have a religious, the Moyle, who does it?
Right. It's a complicated issue. I mean, I feel a little uncomfortable when people use the term religious reasons because there's such a range of rationales for it, and the majority of circumcisions that are done by Jewish people aren't done according to the prescribed religious way on the seventh day by a religiously authorized person with the other requirements that are stated. So then it becomes the question of, well, is it being done primarily or exclusively because of the religion? In some cases, I'm sure it is. In other cases, it may be done for basically the same reasons that the non-Jewish people do it, because they become accustomed to it in the U.S., and it's to some extent it's become the cultural default. So,
well, and I'll say in my case, it's ignorance, because we've spoken about this before, but if folks are new to the program, I have three sons. I circumcised them all in the hospital before I left. My dad's circumcised. My brothers are circumcised. I just assume that that's what you do. I didn't do any research. I didn't look through any resources. Their father was Jewish, but we were raising them Catholic, so it wasn't about that. And as I've grown as a human being, and I have to credit you, Stephen, with what you have enlightened me, if I had to do it today, I wouldn't. And I've had this conversation with my three sons, and two of the three of them agree with me, but one wants to hold out because he wants to look like everybody else. Fast forward, I have a brother who's circumcised, who has two sons who are 3 and 6. They didn't circumcise their sons. So there is change, it seems, albeit slowly, but I'm noticing it within just my family, so I can only imagine. The numbers of circumcised, I don't mean numbers of procedures, but percentages. Wasn't it not like 70% were circumcised in the United States and 30% were not, and now it's getting 50-50-ish?
That's right. It was actually probably as high as around 90% at one point. And, the rates are down around 50-50 now. There's a lot of complicating factors because immigrants tend not to do it unless they're trying to adopt the U.S. practice. And, of course, we have a higher percentage of immigrants than we used to have. So there's a lot of factors that affect the rates. You know, it is a complicated issue. And your son who is defending it, I mean, that's an understandable reaction. And I feel sorry, Maria, that you weren't given the proper information. And, I wish the people who in your position wouldn't fault themselves. And I also have to say that a lot of the physicians, to some extent, are in this situation too, because the medical schools don't teach things properly. There are medical textbooks that don't show the intact penis and don't talk about the intact penis and the reasons how it needs to be cared for and why it needs to be maintained in its natural state, because it does have, the foreskin does have functions, immunological, protective and erogenous, three different sets of functions, and the tissue's there for a reason. It's not just extra skin, as some circumcision proponents have said.
Well, and I would imagine it's got nerve endings, right? It has to have nerve endings, because I used to say to my physician, after you've done the procedure, please bring them to me so I can nurse them, and they would come back to me sobbing, unable to catch their breaths, and latch on. So this, I guess, was before they even anesthetized them. You know, my sons are 23, 25, and 27. So the foreskin has feeling, right?
Right. It's one of the most richly nerve-laden parts of the entire body, in fact. And even today, there's circumcisions done without anesthetic, which is amazing. But it wasn't all that long ago that doctors were saying that, the child doesn't feel anything, their nervous system hasn't developed to the point where they can really feel pain, it won't hurt them. Or another argument is somehow because they forget about it, quote-unquote, they don't remember it when they're an adult, and somehow it's okay, it didn't hurt them or something, which is ridiculous. But David Chamberlain has conclusively refuted these arguments. He has a new book coming out, just came out actually, But it's absurd, but so much of this is absurd. And if you spend the time to look into it a little bit, you realize its absurdity. But again, most people don't do that. They trust the doctors. Even today, with the internet and everything, there's certainly more scrutiny of doctors going on, which is a good thing to some extent, but still, people trust their doctors, and well, they should. I mean, the doctors are the experts in medical issues. Why wouldn't you trust them?
But it's funny because I have a girlfriend. She is in her early 30s. She just had her third child, a son, I think it's 4 weeks ago today. And I said to her, are you going to circumcise? She was like, absolutely. And I said, you should really look into that. And she was like, there's no way I'm not. And that was the end of the discussion. So we're talking about the next generation. There was like, she was like, what? You know, I mean, my husband is, my dad is, of course he's going to be circumcised. So that it's still pervasive. So I'm curious about, I think what I'd like to view life as, getting people information, then when you have the knowledge, then I think you make an informed decision and you make a better decision. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to agree with what you're doing with your organization or what my feelings are about it, but at least the knowledge will help provide it. So obviously that's what you're doing with your organization, right, is getting, or are you just refuting the science? Because one of the next topics we need to discuss is that people say that circumcised penises are better with HIV transmission not being an issue.
Yeah, there's so many issues to talk about. It's hard to even know where to begin. But, you know, our organization is really not primarily devoted to trying to pass a law against male circumcision or something like that. It's primarily we need to educate people. We need to educate the public. We need to educate the lawyers and the judiciary. And people really need to think about these things and know that there's been a lot of scholarship about human rights and legal problems with male circumcision. I mean, there's so many bright people out there turning their attention to this issue, and it's mostly people that aren't known to those who are working on the issue in an organized way. It's just happening all the time now, and I agree with you that the most important thing is to talk about it, and so often that doesn't happen. So often people don't think about it. It becomes a default. It's almost like a religious thing, like people say this thing about, I have to do it, my husband's circumcised, or my other son is circumcised, or whatever it is. It almost becomes like a mandate, but not a mandate from a genuine religion, but just a mandate sort of from they feel compelled to do it. And I hear this over and over, and it's an odd thing, really. It's a very odd thing. The other odd thing is that I've heard a lot of Christians say that they think it's religiously mandated. Some people think it's legally mandated, too, which is extremely odd, but I have heard those statements repeatedly.
Well, can you speak about the World Health Organization and their promoting the fact that it's a benefit with prevention of HIV?
Sure. I was at the UN in 2001, and we had some discussions with the World Health Organization, and it's been disappointing. I think there's a couple things going on. I think there's a reluctance to look at the issue, perhaps because some people aren't used to thinking of males as having been wronged in some way. It's just not an accepted way of thinking, and so the concept that there might be some issue that males might be complaining about has people sort of rolling their eyes or sort of thinking, oh, well, there's more important things for us to be doing or something like that. And I think that perception affects the World Health Organization. But I also think that there's a certain level of actual concern, and they actually do want to help the world, and they actually do want to fulfill their role as the World Health Organization. And some see that this evidence that's been put together that's very shaky, but there's enough of it out there now, and Johns Hopkins, unfortunately, has been one of the leading institutions in purveying this. There's enough of this so-called evidence out there now that people are really starting to believe it. I mean, even the American Academy of Pediatrics in their position statement last year, which sort of came out in favor of circumcision without being too blamed about it, because I think they didn't feel they could be too blamed about it, but even that statement basically admitted that the HIV argument doesn't make sense, and that even if it was true in Africa, it totally doesn't translate to America, where the methods of transmission are completely different, and where you're talking about infant circumcision versus adult in Africa. So it's just a crazy argument. But again, it seems that the advocates of circumcision just feel compelled to find some reason. There's got to be some reason. It's crazy. It's craziness. I mean, why?
Well, and I'm curious.
Lay down the knife, as Intact America has said. Lay down the knife.
Intact. Now, there's so many subjects that we can go through, because we've talked in the past, too, about men trying to restore their foreskin so that they can be look and not be circumcised, if you will, or, you know, retro or something like that, which I don't know how – is that practiced much anymore? Because that's been several years since that was
in the news.
You know,
there's an organization that focuses specifically on that. I mean, we focus more on circumcision rather than on restoration. We totally support men who are interested in foreskin restoration, and we've heard, you know, very glowing reports. Of course, it never gets you back what you lost, but it does give you back more sensitivity. It's not really our area of expertise, but it does seem like it's a very valuable thing. And there's been a lot of improved technology in the last 5 to 10 years, and thousands of men are doing it. It's not a fringe thing anymore.
Restoration?
Foreskin restoration, yeah. It's not. You'll hear about it in sort of more mainstream channels. You'll read an article by someone who's not an activist on these issues, just a scholar, and they will have heard about foreskin restoration, whereas 5 or 10 years ago that wouldn't happen.
And then there were other stories that if you weren't circumcised, that could create problems in women, either cervical or vagina issues or whatever, because
of... Yeah, that evidence has been completely debunked, but these issues, and, you know, penile cancer was another one. These issues just never go to rest. You know, they just keep turning up. I mean, you know, it gets completely debunked, and in another 10 years, someone will come out with an article citing the earlier articles, and that there's still good research. I mean, this person, Castel Sage, a Barcelonan researcher and a team, put out another article resuscitating, again, the old arguments, and you can imagine when you've been in this work for a while and you've seen the suggested rationales disproven, it's frustrating to have them completely
come back
continually
again.
Reappearing,
yeah.
which is happening. The AAP, again, to go back to this report, the AAP...
The American Academy of Pediatrics.
Right, the American Academy of Pediatrics. You know, they try to justify circumcision, but they themselves admit that they don't have a quantified version of the harm, so you can't justify benefits versus harm when you don't know the harm. And in any event, benefits versus harm is the wrong calculation, because that's designed for a prophylactic, for a medically beneficial procedure, which circumcision is not. So the whole thing is just craziness. And can I talk a little about the AAP statement a little more? Because there's been a lot of good news the last year, and I'd like to sort of focus on some of that.
And is that their policy statement, or is it their reaction to your article?
Well, both. It's sort of the same thing. So you know, there's these policy statements that come out from time to time. The previous one was in 1999, and it was slightly, it was better than the one that came out in 2012. So it took 13 years. In 2012, they came out with this long-awaited statement. It was a delay of about 3 or 4 years that was pretty clearly attributable to the work of ARC and our sister organizations, because we've been working with the American Academy of Pediatrics and sort of bring to their attention some of the reasons why support for circumcision doesn't make sense. And so anyway, they finally came out with this position, and it just had so many holes, it's hard to even know where to begin. And, you know, we published an electronic letter that was sent to the pediatrics and rejected, but that was cited by the German Pediatric Association. And Bob Van Hal and I published an article about in the Journal of Medical Ethics about the AAP policy statement, and the AAP did this amazingly unprecedented thing, pretty much unprecedented, which was to actually reply as an organization to our paper in the pages of the Journal of Medical Ethics, and they didn't really have anything to say. They sort of said that everything we said was wrong, but they couldn't point to anything specific, and they sort of implied that we were being ad hominem, sort of attacking the person rather than the issue, which was totally untrue. We were just talking about the issues. We had nothing other than the issues in our paper at all, and they couldn't point to any example of it. So it was this odd thing where they tried to claim there were all these problems with it, but they couldn't point to any. And the similar thing happened in Europe. A European group, a large European group headed by Morten Frisch, published a critique, it was shorter, less detailed, but to the same effect, basically, in Pediatrics itself, the AAP's journal, and the AAP also responded to that, and again, tried to refute it, but didn't really have anything substantive to say. So, you know, if you look at some of what the Pediatric Organization has done on other issues, they've done very good work, they've written very well about a wide variety of issues. It's just a very odd thing that they have such a inability to see this particular issue. It's just very strange.
Has there been, what could you reference that the American Academy of Pediatrics has maybe done a reversal on in the past? Something that was normal, like the mercury drops
well,
in the eyes?
Well, they had a very odd position statement on female genital cutting, which really, really was surprising because in 2010, because they seemingly were trying to, well, not even seemingly, they were trying to justify minor forms of genital nicks, sort of minor genital cutting, which is completely illegal under the federal law. And there was an uproar when they put this out, and a month later they retracted it. But the really interesting thing is to look at how this highlights the difference in attitude toward male circumcision versus female, because if there's any difference, it's really a difference in kind rather than a difference in degree. I mean, in both cases, you're cutting out functional tissue. And
Stephen, you know, if our listeners aren't familiar with female genital mutilation, will you describe what some of the procedures are?
It's a complex issue in itself, so I probably don't have time to go into that in too much detail, but there are several different types of female genital cutting, some of which are more or less histologically analogous to male circumcision, some of which are probably more serious, and some of which are less serious if they just involve, they don't involve tissue removal, basically. And so the AAP was doing this odd thing of trying to justify in violation of federal law, really, the more minor forms of female genital cutting, and then they had to disavow this a month later. So it's just a strange series of events.
Because it's been in the news about female genital mutilation because there's some countries that do it because they think it staunches the female sexual drive, and or it, well, obviously, it's because they've cut off the clitoris, right?
Well, some forms of it do, yeah. And you know, obviously, like, we're not, all forms of male genital cutting, we deplore. All forms of female genital cutting, we deplore it. And you one can make a sort of a hierarchy of which procedures are worse or more drastic. Again, you know, we don't see a lot of value in that. I mean, we really deplore all these practices. And,
right, but I was just wanting to give somebody a frame of reference because if they didn't know that was also done on females, as you say, you espouse both. It's cutting is cutting. You don't distinguish between genders or procedures or whatever.
Well, cutting is cutting, and in fact, one leading opponent of female genital cutting said exactly that: to cut is to cut. And people who try to get so intellectual about it and say, well, this kind of cutting is bad and this kind of cutting isn't bad, I mean, it doesn't really hold water when you really look at it. Honey Lightfoot Klein, who was also who is also a very strong opponent of female genital cutting. She's written three books, and I've worked closely with her in the past, and she has drawn parallels between the justifications for male and female genital cutting, and it's amazing how many parallels there are. I mean, pretty much all the reasons that are suggested for male circumcision, hygiene, social acceptability, et cetera, health reasons, religious reasons, they all carry over into female genital cutting. So I think we have a problem seeing it objectively because we do the one practice and not the other.
Mm-hmm.
But people in countries that aren't sort of limited because of that are able to see that the differences are not as dramatic as some might think. And you know, that sort of ties into recent developments in Germany because in June 2012, a regional court upheld the right to bodily integrity in the context of male circumcision, and that's the first time that's ever happened in a court of law sort of squarely on the issues of holding the right to bodily integrity as it relates to circumcision. So that was an extremely important event.
Yes, but what does that mean?
More or less, Stephen,
what does that mean to the Germans? It means that it's not mandated? It means that it's disallowed?
It means that you cannot do a male circumcision without violating a man's right to bodily integrity. unless there are some compelling reasons otherwise, which almost never is the case. Now this, I do need to mention that this court case was overturned by legislation. There was a fairly big uproar about it, and some of the legislators felt compelled to pass legislation saying that, in fact, male circumcision was not a violation of the Constitution. And a number of legislators actually resisted that. Around 100 legislators in Germany said, well, in fact, the court case was right. So that was a very courageous position for them to take. But this was overturned. But that is irrelevant to the fact that this court has really stood up and said for the first time that this is a violation of the law and of human rights. And it's actually a fairly straightforward application of human rights principles. You don't have to be particularly, you don't have to have a particularly detailed analysis to come to this conclusion, but it's still pretty important to have this actually be handed down in a respected court.
So,
there's a whole set of, well, in fact, the next paper I'm writing is about the German developments. I'm going to be presenting it in the UK in September, and there's a whole, and I talked about it in Helsinki too last year, October, but that was before the legislation had happened. That was when the court case had happened, but the law hadn't been passed yet. So
Germany's
anyway,
court.
The second piece of good news from the last year.
But Stephen, Germany's court passed legislation that said it's a violation of the law to and human rights if you have a circumcision. Then the legislature overturned that?
The legislature reversed it more or less.
Is it going through the process like we do up to their Supreme Court, if you will?
No, the parliament, the analogy is would be to our Congress. This happens in the U.S. too, that the Supreme Court, it wasn't the Supreme Court in Germany, it was a court below that, but this happens in the U.S. too, that a court makes a decision and then Congress is lobbied by its constituents and is convinced to legislatively overturn the legal decision by saying that, well, in fact, this is legal, despite the fact the court said it's illegal. In fact, it's legal. And the validity of the legislation is questionable, which is one of the things I'm writing about. The story isn't over yet. I mean, there's good reason to think that the law actually isn't valid.
So you're saying that this story is still unfolding in Germany?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, this bill was passed less than a year ago, so there's still a lot of analysis of it going on and discussion, and there's likely to be further developments.
So when you speak about addressing something in Helsinki and then next, or this September, you're going to address something in the UK, what are these, conferences, conventions, assemblies?
Yeah, conferences. There's a biannual symposium that's been happening since 1989, and the last one was in Helsinki, and it was a great event. The ombudsman from Norway came and spoke and was very impressive, children's ombudsman, and the next one is going to be in Boulder, Colorado in 2014. And then the event in the UK, there's a very active organization called General Autonomy, and the name of the organization is also the principle of genital autonomy. Basically, is all persons, male, female, and intersex, which means people who are neither clearly male nor female but are somewhere in between, all persons should have the right to control their own bodily integrity. And so the principle of genital autonomy is a very important one, and the organization that bears that name has periodic conferences, and the next one is in the UK in September. I'll be speaking there.
So you got to be the rock star of that group.
Well, there's a lot of interesting thinking going on. There's a lot of people. I mean, I appreciate your kind words, and certainly, you know, I have greatly benefited because there's so many people thinking about these things creatively and working hard on them. And there's Michael Thompson at the University of Kiel, for example, has been working on these issues for a while and has organized a couple of these conferences. And so, yeah, I mean, we're really blessed because William Brigman had the first article in 1986, and at that point was pretty isolated. And at this point, there's just a lot of work going on around this issue and a lot of activists and just so much happening.
Let me mention one more thing,
though, because it's interesting. I mean, you could knock me over with a feather. We got an invitation to speak in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Medical University of South Carolina in October. at an ethical conference, and we're the only, I'm the only non-physician who's being invited to speak. I'm debating Dr. Susan Blank, the AAP's sort of head of the circumcision task force. The two of us are debating whether circumcision should be illegal, and that would be a very interesting event. And some of the other sort of leading ethical thinkers on the pro-circumcision side have been going to be there, although they're not going to be speaking on circumcision. They're going to be speaking on other topics, Douglas Bikema and Lane Friedman Ross. It should be quite an interesting event. We're all going to be on the same panel on the second day. And it's open to the public. You have to pay a fee to be there, but anyone who wants to attend can go.
Do you have the date? I know it's October, but the date that you're going to be on?
Yeah, the date is October 18th to 19th.
And you're on the
19th? Friday and Saturday, yes. It should be quite interesting. Ethics is such a, medical ethics is such a rich topic. The Journal of Medical Ethics, in addition to the paper I talked about, I wrote a second one about human rights and circumcision, and looking at the fact that the Convention on the Rights of the Child, even though the U.S. hasn't formally ratified it, is still good law, and even within the U.S., due to principle of customary human rights law. So anyway, the Journal of Medical Ethics is doing a whole issue on circumcision. Their next issue is completely devoted to the topic of male circumcision, and they're having some ethicists who are more in the pro-circumcision camp and several folks who are more aligned with our position. And, the issue is just drawing so much interest.
So what's fascinating to me about this is that you're actually going to be speaking to physicians or with physicians.
It will be very fascinating. It'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. I'm looking forward to it.
Do you know what the forum's going to be
like? In the past, and it's always interesting because, physicians don't like to hear from non-physicians. So one has to be careful how one crafts things, because doctors really have I could call it a bias, but maybe that's an unfair word, because maybe it's not unreasonable, but they have a belief that somebody who's a non-physician doesn't have anything to offer them in terms of thought about medical procedures. And again, that's not necessarily unreasonable, but that's what you're often up against when you're speaking to a physician audience.
Well, as your wife being a physician and a pediatrician, that must put her in a unique field, right?
Well, it's interesting because we both have connections with the American Academy of Pediatrics, right?
Uh-huh.
She's a member. But, I mean, the AAP is actually a good organization. I mean, they've done a lot of good. I mean, it's actually quite a puzzle why they have such an odd position on male circumcision, because apart from that, they've actually done a lot of good and really helped children and really, really tried to help their constituents to serve children effectively. So this one blind spot, which has persisted for so long. I mean, the 1975 statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics on circumcision, their first statement was actually better than their 2013 statement. At 38 years later, I mean, try to figure out how that could be explained.
And you're saying better because it was more sensitive to your cause and not as much now?
If you look at the statement from 2013, the position statement and the policy statement and the technical report was the longer document that accompanied the policy statement. If you analyze those just purely from a statement of a position of logical coherency and, let's check and see if the facts they list support their conclusion, how can you possibly say that a risk-benefit analysis supports a procedure when they also say, we don't know what the risks are, we don't know what the complications are, we still need further research? It doesn't make sense, right? You can't determine a value of a fraction, a numerator and a denominator, unless you know what both numbers are.
And what about
it's
the
impossible.
Adage, first, do no harm?
Well, that's another thing. But Maria, to sort of, even if you go back to the 1989 statement, which was influenced by a highly pro-circumcision doctor who was the head of the committee, Edgar Schoen, I mean, that 1989 position statement was the worst if you just view it from a result-oriented standpoint. But even that position statement didn't have the logical inconsistencies and the outright errors and the outright flaws that the 2012 statement did. I mean, that was just what took me aback.
I
mean, it would be one thing if they made an argument, but to make an argument with so many holes in it and so many just outright falsehoods, and they omitted some of the best studies, some of the most helpful studies. They didn't explain away or point to their flaws. They simply didn't mention them, presumably hoping people would know about them or something. I don't know. But that
Stephen,
was the most disturbing point to me. So I say that not because the 2012 statement was the most negative to our opposition, because it isn't. But simply because.
And our time is up. I have to say goodbye to Stephen Svoboda. He is the founder and, I don't know the exact title, Attorneys for the Rights of the Child, ARCLAW.org. This is Maria Sanchez. You're listening to The Maria Sanchez Show. Have a fabulous weekend, and we look forward to you joining us on Monday.
The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.